We are ready to hear arguments in the first case. The appellant is ready. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is James Lamb. I'm appearing this morning for Mr. Lujan. And if possible, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
You'll just have to watch your own time.
Okay. Understood, Your Honor. Thank you. May it please the Court, today's case requires the Court to compare the Colorado offense of trespass to an automobile to the federal generic definition of a crime involving moral turpitude, or CMT, and to determine whether the Colorado statute matches the federal definition or is instead broader than it. To resolve this question, the Court must apply the element-centric version of the categorical approach that the Supreme Court recently announced in Mathis v. United States. Mr. Lujan argues that a correct application of this approach resolves this issue in his favor because his crime is both broader than the federal definition and is not divisible on its intent element. The elements of the crime of criminal trespass to an auto are that the defendant enters any motor vehicle with intent to commit the crime, a crime therein. Now, both parties agree that without more, this crime is broader than the federal definition of a CMT. The disagreement occurs on whether the last element is actually not a single element, but is instead...
Do we have a generic definition of a CMT? Isn't that sort of an amorphous thing?
It is amorphous. I'm using that as a shorthand. There is sort of a definition of a CMT, but it's made on a case-by-case.
When you're talking about generic and comparisons, it's sort of important to know what we're comparing what to what, right?
Right. So in this case, the crime to enter any motor vehicle with some intent, without more, is not a crime involving moral turpitude. And so if the intent crime were to be an element, then depending on the defendant's intent when he enters the motor vehicle, the crime might or might not be a CIMT. And so it's going to depend on which crime he intended. And in this case, there is a Colorado decision, People v. Williams, in which the Colorado Supreme Court noted that the General Assembly, when it amended the statute in 1992, did so to admit of a broader range of intent crimes, including criminal mischief.
Well, the thing that's, I mean, all of this is very good and appropriate when we're talking usually about criminal cases specifically, and also 2255s or 2054s, but here we have a removal case. And doesn't your client have the burden to show whether or not this is a crime of moral turpitude or not?
Well, Judge Briscoe, we're arguing that we don't get that far, that we can resolve this issue categorically. And there is no dispute, I believe, that under a pure version of the categorical
approach. And he has carried that burden to prove that.
We would not agree with that, Your Honor, because the burden issue comes up when there's divisibility in the statute. And we don't concede that there is a burden, I should say, but the burden issue comes up when...
Well, he's seeking to cancel removal, right?
Correct.
And doesn't he have the burden?
He does have the burden in the underlying proceeding. He has the factual burden of demonstrating his eligibility for relief from removal. However, a categorical approach, as the Supreme Court has stated, sits separate and apart from the underlying inquiry in which it occurs. And the Supreme Court said that explicitly in Moncrief v. Holder. And so it is a pure legal inquiry. It is intended to compare the elements, the bald legal definition of the crime, and not the facts, to the federal definition that we're dealing with to determine whether the two are a match or not.
But you would agree, would you not, that that if the intent element is internally divisible, then you would lose now under the Lucius Reyes case?
Right. Under Lucio Reyes, if the intent element is, in fact, divisible, we lose. And I will note in that respect that we'd like to preserve the argument that Lucio Reyes was decided incorrectly. I'll note that our firm, along with several others, are working on a petition for rehearing en banc in that case now. And there's also a great deal of activity in the Ninth Circuit on these issues. So conceding that if Lucio Reyes is good law, we lose. However, I think it is very clear, Judge Bacharach, that the final element of this crime is not divisible. And we have the Supreme Court case of People v. Williams, in which the court confronted the issue of whether a charging document in a criminal prosecution that charges only the elements of this crime without specifying an underlying intent crime is substantively defective because it fails to fully and completely describe the crime, any crime under Colorado law. And in People v. Williams, the court explained that a criminal charging document that does not recite each and every essential element of the crime is substantively defective. A defendant in a criminal prosecution need not lift a finger to defend himself. The prosecutor has literally described a crime.
I think in a lot of decisions, we and other courts have thrown around the word element when it really wasn't an element. And I think we've always also said that it is enough to charge in a criminal case by mere reciting of the violation of the crime itself. And often, when you look at that clear statement of the crime, it does not include what ultimately is broken out as elements in an instruction, for instance.
So the Colorado Supreme Court in People v. Williams did say that all of the elements have to appear. And
they just don't know what they meant when they said elements.
They distinguished them from the underlying facts of the case. So from those essential facts that have to be proven at trial, not necessarily all the facts, but those that must be proven at trial. And what they said was that failure to charge the underlying intent crime is a defect of form, because arguably, if the defendant doesn't know which crime he's charged with having intended to commit, he can't defend himself. And the court very carefully distinguished this type of error from a substantive error, where all of the essential elements are not in fact charged. And tellingly, in my view, Judge Martinez, in dissenting from the majority opinion, explicitly noted in his dissent that the majority's opinion meant that a Colorado jury need not necessarily agree on the crime of intent in order to convict a defendant.
Let me follow up.
And you're agreeing with the dissent? Where are you on that then?
Obviously, we do. I think the dissent nailed the point that there's a difference between the essential elements and the facts of the case.
Okay.
I just wanted to follow up on Judge Briscoe's question. On page 60 of People v. Williams, they do include the state Supreme Court includes the sentence that you're talking about. An information that fails to charge an essential element of an offense is substantively defective. But the very next sentence reflects what Judge Briscoe was referring to, and this essential element requirement is satisfied if the language in the charge tracks the statutory language. So, to me, the struggle in the case turns largely on how do we interpret the consecutive placement of those two sentences. Clearly, they were referring to the absence of an element as a substantive defect, but the very next sentence reflects of what it means to be a substantive defect, and there was no substantive defect because they tracked the statutory language in the charging document. So isn't there some sort of ambiguity in People v. Williams about what it actually meant to be a substantive defect by virtue of the absence of specifying what the intent, the underlying intent was?
I think if there had been ambiguity as to whether it was an element or a fact, we might not have had Justice Martinez's response. I also think that what we're talking about that might have to be charged in a criminal indictment simply a charging document are the facts of the crime, because in a lot of cases, you know, we might charge he intended to commit some crime. And then if you look at a criminal indictment or a charging document, you'll see another set of sentences explaining what the crime was, when it happened, where it happened, et cetera, et cetera. What the Supreme Court in Mathis is telling us is that those facts are simply irrelevant. And I think it's notable that this court previously had a broader version of the categorical approach, which admitted of facts, And in Venzor-Granillo, in fact, this court found that this precise statute was divisible on that element. But the court was very clear on what it was doing. It stated explicitly that there's an element-centric categorical approach that we use in certain limited circumstances, and there's a broader categorical approach that allows us to look at the facts that underlay the elements. And that categorical approach is the one that the Ninth Circuit also endorsed in Aguila Montes de Oca, the United States. And that's significant because that case was expressly overruled by the Supreme Court in De Camps v. United States, which disapproved that approach. And so our position today is that the only version of the categorical approach that remains good law is the element-centric categorical approach. And I would also like to point out that this approach to the categorical approach serves a number of policy interests that the Supreme Court has identified, most prominently that it allows non-citizens to craft plea agreements with a certain degree of certainty that those plea agreements will not come back to haunt them later based on undisputed facts. And the Supreme Court stated this policy interest in Malouli v. Holder, 135 Supreme Court, 1980. It also repeated the same policy interest in Padilla v. Kentucky in requiring that attorneys accurately advise non-citizens of the potential immigration consequences of guilty pleas. The court also noted it in De Camp. And so without an element-centric categorical approach, we enter a landscape where it is possible for a defendant to craft a plea and then years later have the facts of that plea in a later post hoc review come back to haunt him. And in addition, an element-centric approach protects the defendant's Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights by ensuring that in a later proceeding, under the whether that be under the INA or under the Armed Career Criminal Act, that his he is only held to what he necessarily pled guilty to, or what the jury necessarily found him guilty of. I also like to note that this element-centric approach, it does not result in a windfall for non-citizens, particularly people situated like Mr. Lujan, who is removable whether or not he has any criminal history at all. The question is, does he get to go in front of an immigration judge and ask for discretionary relief? And if this court finds that this statute is divisible in this way, he will not even be able to ask. And if there are no further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
I just have one very brief question. Do you concede that we lack jurisdiction over the issue involving sua sponte, the denial of the refusal to sua sponte reopen?
What I'll say to that is that I think the issues presented are identical, and we will not, I'm not going to argue that you do have jurisdiction.
Which means we don't.
Which suggests you don't.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Jessica Doggart for the Attorney General. This Court should dismiss the petition for review that was filed after the Board's sua sponte decision, as was just discussed, and it should deny the remaining petition for review because Lujan has not shown that his conviction for trespass of a vehicle with the intent to commit a crime therein is not a crime involving moral turpitude. I'll jump right to the discussion about Mathis and the element-centric approach. There's no question here that Mathis is the approach that should be applied. The court should look to the categorical, and look at the statute of conviction and determine the elements of the statute of conviction and then compare those elements to the generic crime of a crime involving moral turpitude. Here we don't get far enough to compare the elements because we don't know what the elements are. In looking at the categorical approach, it's uncontested that the statute is divisible both as to the dwelling and the motor vehicle aspect of the crime. The next question is to whether or not the intent to commit a crime therein is itself an element.
If you lose on the second part, that the intent element is not internally divisible, do you concede that you lose the appeal?
Yes, because there would be crimes that somebody could commit within a vehicle that would not include morally turpitudinous conduct. And an example of one of those crimes would be underage drinking, is a common example. So somebody could enter a motor vehicle unlawfully to commit a crime that is by statute illegal but not morally turpitudinous. And so we must look to see whether or not that is a crime. And one of the confusions in this case is because Williams is the most applicable case, but it arose under the context of an indictment and an information. And that is a different standard than what we actually ultimately have to look at under Mathis.
Well, that's true, but the court specifically said what it meant by a substantive defect. And let me ask you about a different portion of Williams, and that is on page 58, where the court said that we conclude that the information charging with Williams with criminal trespass was defective in form but not in substance. And then it said it did not specify the ulterior crime that Williams intended to commit, i.e., identical to this scenario. However, the information recited the statutory elements of the crime of criminal trespass. How then do we take the best evidence of what the Colorado Supreme Court defines as the elements of criminal trespass and say that the intent element, what the intent was in fact an element? Didn't the Colorado Supreme Court say to the contrary?
I think we have to tease it out. I don't think it's easy for me to point to one sentence in Williams and answer the question. As Your Honor noted, that the paragraph on page 60 is equally confusing because it discusses the elements required and how the information recited those elements and then tracks the statutory language. And if you read Williams as a whole, what it talks about is the requirements for an information. And that is that the offense charged is set forth with such certainty the court may pronounce judgment upon a conviction. And I'm citing the criminal procedure rules there. And that means that the defendant must be charged with or given notice of the charged offense and the factual circumstances to allow trial preparation and to protect that individual from subsequent prosecution. That's what's important for an information. What's important under Mathis is what the elements a jury must find in order to convict. And those two are not the same. And so we can take language from Williams and we can take discussion from Williams as to what the crime constitutes under the statute, but we can't say that Williams says an element or not. We can
only
read into
it. Well, with regard to the sufficiency of an information, don't you need both? You need to identify all of the elements, and you need to provide enough information that the defendant is on notice of what he or she needs to present in order to defend the charge, right?
Correct.
And then on page 58, part of that, and then you're referring to what I asked your adversary on page 60. But on page 60, this Colorado Supreme Court simply says that the information provided all of the elements because it provided the statutory language. Therefore, it provided all of the elements, but there was no reference in the charging document to what the underlying intent was. So aren't the references on both 58 and 60 pretty unequivocal that with regard to the part of the sufficiency issue that we're concerned about with regard to what is an element, that the Supreme Court was pretty clear in both passages that what the underlying intent is not an element?
I actually disagree, Your Honor. I don't believe that that's what it means. And one answer to that would be to look at cases since Williams. And if you look at People versus Palmer, which is a Court of Appeals case out of Colorado, and that's at 87 P3rd 137, that's a 2003 case. And in that case, and I'm quoting, it says, it is not necessary to allege every element that must be proved at trial in the information. It's just necessary to provide enough information to allow a defendant to prepare for trial and to protect an individual from subsequent prosecution. They need to be alerted to the facts that are necessary to prove that person's guilt at trial. They don't need to be spelled out in each of the terms that a jury must eventually be instructed on. And if you look back at the dissent in Williams, the dissent does talk about that. And I think it's at, I believe, page 65. And it talks about how the jury, how it's a, oh, no, I'm sorry, it's at page 64. And the court talks about how any challenge to the jury instructions that they may have had meat under that claim, but it was waived. And so a challenge to whether or not the jury instructions were sufficient by not naming the ulterior offense may have resulted in a different result, because that was a different inquiry as to whether or not a jury had to know of that ulterior offense in order to convict. And that's what's important here, whether the jury is able to identify the ulterior offense. And if you look also at Colorado law, there are no Colorado cases that I was able to find that demonstrates that a jury only has to find a crime or that they can disagree on what the ulterior crime is. If anything, the jury has to agree on what the ulterior crime is. The jury instructions require that the ulterior crime be specified.
Can't it be in the alternative with intent to, I don't know, rape or steal the car or whatever? You could do both?
Well, the jury instructions specifically say insert crime here. So it is a specific crime.
Does it say insert crimes?
It says crime. It doesn't say crimes. It says crime. And under, if you look at the People versus Palmer case that I just cited, in that case, the question was whether or not the victim was identified, and they found that the specific identity of the victim was not an element of the underlying crime, so it didn't matter that that wasn't presented to the jury. And so it talked about what the jury had to find in order to convict, and it had to find the elements of that underlying crime. So that is, again, an instruction that we need to find what that underlying crime is in order to convict. And then one more thing I would like to reference in terms of Williams is under Mathis, the Supreme Court talks about how you distinguish whether or not something is a means or an element. And they said that a means is something that has no legal significance. An element is something that has some sort of legal consequence attached to it. And that's at page, I believe, 2248 of Mathis. And here it's clear that whatever significance there is a legal consequence to the ulterior crime. The Colorado Supreme Court has an en banc case as to the legal significance of that ulterior offense. There is a legal consequence as to that ulterior crime.
Well,
it's a defective form.
What do you mean by that? Do you mean that there has to be an intent to commit an underlying crime, or to take Judge Briscoe's hypothetical, does it matter, for example, would it exonerate a defendant if he or she were to say, well, if the information charge that I broke into a car with intent to commit a rape, or to steal a car, or to drink. And so the jury, six jurors find that there was an intent to commit rape, six jurors find that it was an intent to drink alcohol. The defendant is guilty in either case, right, of trespass to an automobile.
If those ulterior crimes are found.
If there is one or the other of those underlying crimes. In other words, there has to be an intent to commit an underlying crime. Nobody questions that that's an element. The issue is, are there different penalties that are associated, or is there some requirement for unanimity about which underlying crime there was? And I don't know of any Colorado case law to suggest that there's a different penalty depending on what the underlying crime is, or that there's a requirement for unanimity on which crime that the intent involved.
Correct. There's no difference to penalty. And I'm not sure I agree about the unanimity as to what the underlying crime is, because the way the statute is phrased is as intent to commit a crime therein. And if you look at the case law talking about the crimes that are committed therein, it specifies specific crimes. Even Williams itself talks about assault and attempted robbery. Those are the two crimes that were intended to commit. And Williams said it's a defect as to form because he knew that the underlying crimes were assault and attempted robbery. Now, we don't know whether or not he can be convicted of one and not the other, and whether the jury would have to agree on which one. There is no case law on that. But I would submit that they would have to agree on one or the other. He trespassed to commit a crime, trespassed to commit assault, or trespassed to commit attempted robbery. I'm not sure the jury could disagree and still commit as to which one he intended to commit therein. I'm not sure that would.
In this immigration case, which I think it is, although it's starting to feel like a direct criminal appeal, who has the burden here to show what this statute is or isn't?
It's a question of law. So the burden ultimately to prove eligibility for cancellation of removal is petitioner's burden. Under Mathis, the position is that because it's a question of law under the categorical approach, it's a legal discussion.
Is Mathis an immigration case?
Mathis is an Armed Career Criminal Act case, but has been applied in immigration cases across the country. And
did it bleed into who has the burden in a removal case? Or do we just jump right into this is a new law, so let's play with it?
So the burden comes into play because it's a de novo legal issue. The burden comes into play once we get past the categorical approach. So assume we decide.
I don't think that was the question, was it?
Correct. It was.
The question is, did Mathis deal with the question of burden?
Mathis did not deal with the question of burden of proof. No, I'm sorry. If I wasn't correct.
In an immigration case.
In an immigration case, correct. And the burden of proving, Mr. Lujan admitted removability. He's seeking cancellation. That is his burden to prove his eligibility. It is his burden to show that that's wrong, correct?
And it's his burden to show that what he committed was not. He has to prove a negative, as I understood before I came into this room. He has to prove that he was not found guilty of a crime of moral turpitude.
Correct.
And so has he proven that?
No. Because even if this court finds the statute divisible, which it should, as to that ulterior offense, we can't ascertain the elements to which he pled guilty. The record of conviction is ambiguous, and we don't know what the ulterior offense is. So there is no way for us to discuss and compare those elements to the generic definition of a CIMT to determine whether or not he's met his burden.
So does Mathis determine that a jury must decide unanimously what specific crime it is convicting under?
Yes.
I know you've been asked that before.
Yes.
In a different context by Judge Bacharach.
Yes. So under Mathis, any element requires jury unanimity. So if it's something that a jury must unanimously convict on, which is why I believe there's such a strong distinction between an indictment or an information and what ultimately must be instructed to a jury and found by a jury, because those are two very different standards. And while Williams is incredibly instructive to this case, it's not dispositive one way or another because it does deal with an information, and we're talking about what a jury must find in order to convict. And in that vein, I direct the court to both the Rodriguez and the Archuleta cases out of Colorado. The Rodriguez case is an appellate court case. It's at 43 P3rd 641.
And that's in your briefing?
It is in my briefing, yes. And it discusses the ulterior offense. And what it holds is that the intent to commit a crime therein clause applies only to the motor vehicle element. But it discusses it in terms of having some sort of legal significance and consequence, which brings us back to Mathis and makes it an element under Mathis.
So this case really is about an interpretation of Mathis, correct?
Correct. And Archuleta is the burglary case that finds the ulterior crime to be an element that the jury must specifically find in the burglary statute, which has the same exact intent to commit a crime therein requirement. If the court has no other further questions, I would just submit that the government's position is that Mr. Lujan did not show a due process violation and was entitled to a full and fair hearing, and that the court should deny the petition for review. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I would just like to make a couple of points here regarding the government's contentions. First of all, I want to make clear that the burden issue does not arise under a pure categorical approach. It does not arise, I think, even the government admits that. It only arises if we get to the point where we decide this statute is divisible. Secondly, I'd like to...
Well, don't we know that right away when it says either building or car?
What Mathis told us is that in some cases a disjunctively enumerated list can be a single element. So, for example, in a burglary statute, you might have dwelling, structure, boat, or other vehicle. And the question then that was at issue at Mathis is how do you figure out whether those are elements or means? And Mathis set forth a number of tests. And all of these tests, this statute before us today, the Colorado Criminal Trespass Statute, fails. There's no disjunctive wording in this statute. There is no variability in sentencing. It is always a Class 5 felony, which means that it fails the Apprendi v. New Jersey test for what is an element. The record of conviction does not specify the intent crime. And finally, we have People v. Williams. I'd also like to note that some of the cases that the government raised, Rodriguez, my reading of this case, stands only for the notion that we're figuring out what the elements of criminal trespass are versus the elements of dwelling. And it explained that that intent portion does not apply to criminal trespass to a dwelling. And that's all my read of Rodriguez gave to me. Archuleta is a pre-amendment case. So this statute was significantly amended along with the burglary statute in 1992. And prior to that, it is absolutely true that a prosecutor had the charge an underlying intent crime, and that is because the statutory language was fundamentally different prior to the 1992 amendments. And I see that my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. The case is submitted.